Welcome to this podcast from the Protection of Conscience Project. The project supports healthcare workers who want to provide the best care for their patients without violating their own personal or professional integrity. Physicians and other healthcare providers are called to service, not servitude.
Hello, I'm Sean Murphy, the administrator of the Protection of Conscience Project. Welcome to a project podcast about the annual meeting of the Canadian Medical Association happening in Halifax in August 2015. We're going to take a look at a major policy document that's being considered by CMA delegates from across the country, the Association's Draft Framework for Physician-Assisted Suicide and Euthanasia. The best introduction to this topic is a headline about the CMA meeting from Canada's National Post. Quotes, help eligible patients end lives or refer them to someone who will, CMA to urge MDs, close quotes. The headline sums it up. Doctors who don't want to lethally inject patients or write lethal prescriptions are being told that they don't have to do the killing, but they have to refer patients wanting these services to someone who will. The CMA is facing this issue because the Supreme Court of Canada has ordered that physician-assisted suicide and physician-administered euthanasia must become legal in February of next year. But most physicians don't want to kill patients or help them commit suicide. Now, the Supreme Court said that nothing in its ruling compels physicians to do so, and that a decision to participate in euthanasia or assisted suicide, or not, is a matter of conscience. And not even euthanasia and assisted suicide advocates are suggesting that doctors who object to killing patients should be forced to do so themselves. But they do very often claim that physicians who won't kill have a duty to help patients find a colleague who will. And on this point, there's a fundamental conflict. Because many doctors who believe that killing people is wrong also believe that it's wrong to help someone obtain euthanasia or assisted suicide. This is, in fact, the way most people think. People who think drug trafficking is wrong won't sell drugs themselves, but they also won't help someone find a local drug dealer. The Canadian Medical Association includes doctors who are against euthanasia and doctors who are in favor, some who would support it in some situations, and others who never would. But the CMA is officially in favor of euthanasia and assisted suicide on any terms set by the law, and it says that all patients should have equitable access to both. Further, it says that the medical profession as a whole is obliged to support access to both. So the CMA has taken sides, and because it says that it represents the whole medical profession, it's in a position to set the whole weight of the medical profession against physicians who want nothing to do with euthanasia and assisted suicide. Despite having taken sides, the CMA leadership wants to respect freedom of conscience and religion among physicians. The draft framework that's being presented to delegates at the National Conference is supposed to ensure patient access to euthanasia and assisted suicide, while also ensuring that physicians who refuse to participate are not penalized. But just what does participate mean? Does participate include facilitating euthanasia or assisted suicide by referral or other means? Or does participate mean only doing the actual killing oneself? Unfortunately, CMA officials told the Supreme Court of Canada one thing, but have been telling CMA members something else. When the CMA intervened as a friend of the court in the Carter case, which ended up with the legalization of assisted suicide and euthanasia, it told the Supreme Court, quotes, no physician should be compelled to participate in or provide medical aid in dying to a patient, close quotes. The difference between providing euthanasia or assisted suicide and participating in either is the difference between lethally injecting a patient and helping the patient find someone with the needle. The CMA leadership told the Supreme Court of Canada that no physician should be compelled to do either. No physician should be compelled to provide or participate. But when CMA officials now promise to protect physicians who don't want to participate in euthanasia or assisted suicide, Dr. Jeff Blackmer of the CMA's Office of Ethics says participate means only actually giving the lethal injection or writing the lethal prescription. So, in contrast to what they told the Supreme Court, it seems that the protection being offered by CMA officials is limited to those who don't want to do the killing themselves. More could be said about this, but here we want to look at the draft framework for euthanasia and assisted suicide that the CMA Board of Directors is asking delegates to approve at the Association's annual General Council in Halifax. The project has posted an annotated version of the document with links to the original. You can find it on the project website. Visit www.conscienceLaws.org. In the search box in the upper right, type Revised Annotated Draft and click on Search. That will bring up the link to the annotated version, and you can follow along during the next part of this podcast, which we'll resume in a moment. The CMA's original draft framework concerning euthanasia and assisted suicide was used during a consultation in June and July. It's been revised to take into account feedback received during the consultation. CMA delegates meeting in Halifax will be presented with the revised draft framework. With the exception of two tables, this revised document has been reproduced and annotated on the Protection of Conscience Project website, showing the changes made as a result of the consultation. There's a detailed written commentary linked to the annotated copy, but here I'll move through the annotated online draft framework to draw attention to key points. The project does not take a position on the acceptability of euthanasia or assisted suicide, so the focus here is not on that, but on points relevant to the protection of freedom of conscience for physicians who do not wish to be involved with the procedures. The framework has three main divisions: principles-based approach, Schedule A, and Schedule B. We'll deal with each division in separate parts of this podcast. The first section, principles-based approach, is an introductory overview. It briefly discusses the Supreme Court of Canada decision in the Carter case, outlines the action taken by CMA officials since the ruling, and poses three strategic questions that delegates are to consider. There are only two points in this section that attract the project's interest. The draft quotes the criteria for assisted suicide and euthanasia set out by the Supreme Court of Canada. Candidates, in the words of the court, must be competent adults who clearly consent to the termination of life and have a grievous and irremediable medical condition, including an illness, disease, or disability, that causes enduring suffering that's intolerable to the individual. That from the court. The framework's comment is that this is arguably not narrow. Now, this significantly understates the issue by failing to explain what the court meant by irremediable. Any illness, disease, or disability becomes irremediable if the patient considers even successful therapies not acceptable. The breadth of the criteria is important from the project's perspective because the broader the criteria, the more likely it is that conflicts of conscience will arise. Of the three strategic questions, the third, which is actually made up of two questions, is of particular interest. Here it is. For those physicians who refuse to participate in assisted dying for reasons of conscience, how do we reconcile this refusal with their obligation to ensure equitable access? What mechanisms can physicians employ to ensure this access? notice, for those physicians who refuse to participate, by which CMA officials mean only doing the actual killing or personally assisting in suicide. Once this is understood, it becomes clear that the strategic question actually concerns only refusal to perform the lethal act, not a refusal to facilitate it by referral or other means. There is, however, a more important point. The question presumes there's an obligation to ensure equitable access to euthanasia and assisted suicide. But such an obligation is rejected by physicians who, for reasons of conscience, refuse to kill patients or help them commit suicide. So the very question is biased. The question itself subtly imposes a framework for response and discussion that's prejudicial to objecting physicians. Next up, Schedule A. Continuing now with the review of the Canadian Medical Association's draft framework on euthanasia and assisted suicide, we move to the second of the three main divisions of the document, Schedule A. Schedule A is divided into two main sections, foundational principles and recommendations. We'll look briefly at three of the CMA's 10 foundational principles, but first it's important to point out a warning that's been added to the revised document. We're now warned that the foundational principles are only a starting point for ethical reflection. If conflicts arise, as in the case of conscientious objection, there must be further reflection about what the principles mean and how they should be applied. Thus, objecting physicians can't be confident that any of the principles will be interpreted in their favor should a conflict arise, and the CMA's reflection and interpretation may well be affected by its official support for euthanasia and assisted suicide. With this warning in mind, we can now consider the first of three foundational principles that are of particular interest to the project. The first is equity, number two in the CMA framework. That is, as far as possible, anyone who meets the criteria should have access to assisted suicide and euthanasia. So far, so good. But then we're told, physicians will work with relevant parties to support increased resources and access to high-quality palliative care and medical aid in dying. There should be no undue delay to accessing medical aid in dying. Well, physicians will work to support medical aid in dying. Physicians who, for reasons of conscience, object to killing patients or helping them to commit suicide will be happy to collaborate in making palliative care more accessible, but they can't be expected to work to support euthanasia and assisted suicide. That'd be like asking someone opposed to child pornography to support access to it. With respect to undue delay, there should be no undue delay to accessing medical aid in dying. What constitutes undue delay is not defined, and that could be problematic, but we'll see presently that this can't be less than 22 days. The next foundational principle is respect for physician values. It's number three in the CMA document, and I'll quote it here. Physicians can follow their conscience when deciding whether or not to provide medical aid in dying without discrimination. This must not result in undue delay for the patient to access these services. No one should be compelled to provide assistance in dying. Well, the first phrase, when deciding whether or not to provide medical aid in dying without discrimination, well, does this mean that physicians who follow their consciences should not be discriminated against? Or does it mean that in deciding whether or not to provide euthanasia or assisted suicide, physicians must not engage in illicit discrimination? This simply isn't clear. What's more important, however, is that the principle is limited to defending physicians who refuse to provide euthanasia and assisted suicide. No support is offered to physicians who refuse to facilitate euthanasia or assisted suicide by referral or other means. This is consistent with the narrow definition used in the document, but it's not consistent with what the CMA leadership told the Supreme Court of Canada, that, and I quote, "No physician should be compelled to participate in or provide medical aid in dying to a patient," close quote. The third foundational principle, solidarity, is foundational principle number 9. In the first draft of the framework, this said, and I'll quote again, "Patients should be accompanied by physicians and healthcare providers throughout the dying process, regardless of the decisions they make with respect to assisted dying." Patients should be accompanied. Well, the reference to accompanying the patient in solidarity originated in the supportive approach taken in palliative care. For example, a publication of the Canadian Cancer Society describes palliative care as, quotes, "a human solidarity pact," close quotes. And, quotes a palliative care nurse, "palliative care firstly involves accompanying patients through all the symptoms and stages of their disease." But the principle has been changed in the revised draft framework. It now says patients should be supported and not abandoned by physicians and healthcare providers. Again, just to repeat, the first draft said patients should be accompanied by physicians and healthcare providers, but the revised draft says patients should be supported and not abandoned by physicians and healthcare providers. The change is significant for two reasons. First, the concepts of solidarity and accompaniment in palliative care did not develop as aspects of the duty of non-abandonment, so replacing accompaniment with non-abandonment is inappropriate. Second, the substitution is important because it is indicative of bias. Euthanasia and assisted suicide activists frequently hurl accusations of patient abandonment at objecting physicians who refuse to facilitate morally contested procedures by referral or other means. Recall here the warning about how foundational principles are to be interpreted in circumstances of conflict. It's likely that those who support euthanasia and assisted suicide, including the CMA, will use this revised principle as a key to interpreting the recommended policy concerning conscientious objection by physicians, which, as we will see, involves some form of mandatory referral. This brings us to the end of the section on foundational principles, the first of two sections of Schedule A and the draft framework. Next, we'll look at Schedule A's recommendations. Back again with the CMA's draft framework on euthanasia and assisted suicide, looking at Schedule A's recommendations. The recommendations come under five headings. The first two headings are patient qualifications and the process for decision making. Under patient qualifications, two recommendations warrant some attention. First, the importance of an informed decision. The draft framework recommends that patients be advised, among other things, of the certainty of death upon taking the lethal medication. In fact, death is not always certain. researchers acknowledge that assisted suicide and euthanasia drugs don't always work as expected. This ought to be of particular concern to physicians willing to assist with suicide but unwilling to provide euthanasia by lethal injection. They should consider what they may be expected to do if a prescribed drug incapacitates but does not kill a patient. Physicians willing to provide both assisted suicide and euthanasia should disclose and discuss options available in the event that a lethal injection or prescribed drug does not kill the patient. The second point of interest here under patient qualifications is capacity. It's recommended that two physicians must establish that patients are capable of voluntarily requesting and consenting to be killed or helped to commit suicide. What if the patient lacks capacity? Here, the draft framework makes a remarkable suggestion. Here it is, I'll quote, if either or both the attending physician or the consulting physician determines that the patient is incapable, the patient must be referred for further capacity assessment. Either or both. If either the attending or consulting physician determines that the patient is incapable, a further consultation would seem called for to resolve the question. Presumably, the final decision would rest upon a diagnosis agreed upon by two of the three physicians. That makes sense. However, if both the attending and consulting physician conclude that the patient lacks capacity, there would seem to be no reason to seek further opinions. No reason, unless the goal is to find someone willing to certify capacity so that euthanasia or assisted suicide can be provided. No reason, unless the intention is to act upon a certification of capacity by only one physician, despite the existence of two contrary opinions. This is suggestive of assisted suicide and euthanasia activism, of a bias in the document. Under the next heading, the next group of recommendations, comes under the process map for medical decision making. The framework recommends here how requests for euthanasia and assisted suicide should be handled. The process is divided into three stages. Stage 1, requesting it. Stage 2, before undertaking it. And stage 3, after undertaking it. Taking stage 1 and 2 together, the patient is to make three requests, two oral and one written, each to be documented by the attending physician. After the first oral request, the patient must wait at least 15 days before making the second request. The written request cannot be made until at least 7 more days have elapsed, for a total of at least 22 days. Here we see why undue delay, referred to earlier on, can't be less than 22 days. Only when the physician receives a written request, following the two preceding oral requests, is he obliged to begin to act upon it. However, the draft framework includes an important qualification, that shorter timelines be considered in cases of terminal illness where, the document says, time is of the essence. It's not clear why time is of the essence in terminal illness, unless there's a concern that the patient may die of natural causes before a physician can provide euthanasia or assisted suicide. Again, this recommendation is indicative of a euthanasia-assisted suicide activist mindset. Nonetheless, there's room in this framework to accommodate physician freedom of conscience. It appears that the attending physician is not obliged to process your request until a written request is received. It would be possible for an objecting physician to have the necessary exploratory conversations with the patient in conjunction with the first and second oral requests. This would include discussion of options and other issues related to the need to ensure informed consent. During that period, an objecting physician could make clear that if the patient wishes to proceed, the patient must direct a written request to another physician. Should the patient direct the written request to another physician, the new physician would request the transfer of the patient chart. The transferred chart would include the records of the oral requests, so no repetition of the oral requests would be required. The objecting physician could ensure continuity of other aspects of care until the transfer occurred. The project has not encountered objecting physicians who find patient-initiated file transfer problematic, and patient-initiated file transfer is the norm in other jurisdictions in such circumstances. Unfortunately, this approach is neither discussed nor considered in the draft framework. The third stage of the process is called after undertaking medical aid in dying. The context indicates that this means after administering the lethal substance or providing the lethal prescription. Here's what it says. The attending physician or a physician delegated by the attending physician must take care of the patient until the patient's death. Well, to take care of the patient does not mean to remain with the patient. In order to minimize conflicts of conscience among physicians and other healthcare workers, the physician responsible for the decision to provide euthanasia or assisted suicide should personally administer the lethal medication or be present when it's ingested, and remain with the patient until death ensues. This will also better ensure continuity of care at a critical moment, particularly if the medication does not act as expected. Of interest here is the point that the new Quebec euthanasia law requires the physician to remain with the patient until death ensues. Next up, conscientious objection by a physician. Turning now to the CMA framework, draft framework on euthanasia and assisted suicide, we come to the final recommendation provided in the framework, and it's a critical one, conscientious objection by a physician. And here's what it says. Physicians are not obligated to fulfill requests for medical aid in dying. There should be no discrimination against a physician for their refusal to participate in medical aid in dying. In order to reconcile physicians' conscientious objection with patient access to care, a system should be developed whereby referral occurs by the physician to a third party that will provide assistance and information. Now, physicians are not obligated to fulfill requests for medical aid in dying. Fulfill presumably means only performing the lethal act or providing the lethal prescription. And it says there should be no discrimination against a physician for the refusal to participate in medical aid in dying. Remember, according to CMA officials, participate has exactly the same meaning as fulfill, that is, to perform. So, in translation, this means physicians are not obligated to perform euthanasia or assist with suicide, and physicians who refuse to kill patients or help them kill themselves should not be discriminated against. It offers no support for those who refuse to refer patients for the procedure. Again, that is inconsistent with what the CMA told the Supreme Court of Canada. They told the judges, quotes, no physician should be compelled to participate in or provide medical aid in dying to a patient, close quotes. The recommended policy supports physicians unwilling to provide or facilitate euthanasia and assisted suicide only if they refer to a third party. But what does this mean exactly? Objecting physicians might be willing to do this if the nature of this third party is carefully defined. It has to be defined clearly enough to satisfy them that directing the patient to the third party will not constitute morally significant participation in or causal facilitation of euthanasia or assisted suicide. Unfortunately, the formulation in the draft framework is simply too vague on this point. We've now finished with the first two major divisions of the CMA's draft framework on euthanasia and assisted suicide. The last, Schedule B, we'll consider in the next part of this podcast. Schedule B, the last part of the Canadian Medical Association draft framework on euthanasia and assisted suicide, compares legislation in jurisdictions where the procedures are legal with the new Quebec euthanasia law, a bill in the Canadian Senate, and the Trial Court and Supreme Court of Canada decisions in Carter. Schedule B offers three comparative tables. The project is concerned only with the third, which involves reconciling conscientious objection and equitable access. Note that Schedule B considers only one possible method of reconciling freedom of conscience and access to services, compelling a physician who refuses to kill a patient or assist in suicide to refer the patient to someone who will. This effectively excludes other approaches and introduces a fundamental structural bias in favor of mandatory referral. Two questions are proposed with respect to each jurisdiction, Bill S-225 and the Carter decision. The first, is there a duty to refer to another physician? The second, is participation mandatory? The answers offered are yes, no, or silent. In each case, the table purports to provide evidence supportive of the answer. Recall that CMA officials understand participation to mean only directly administering a lethal drug or providing the lethal prescription. Now, this is confusing in a table like this, since the word normally has a broader meaning, and a broader meaning is implied in the Supreme Court of Canada ruling in Carter, not to mention the CMA's own submission in Carter. A review of the answers given to the two questions and what is offered by way of evidence demonstrates that Schedule B is incomplete, erroneous, and substantially misleading. Consistent with the underlying structural bias, all of the erroneous and misleading statements are supportive of mandatory referral. I won't go into all of the details here, which are available in the online annotated version and the related commentary. I'll just give one example. According to the CMA officials who wrote Schedule B, the law in the Netherlands is silent with respect to a duty to refer to another physician, and silent as to whether or not it's mandatory for physicians to participate in euthanasia or assisted suicide. But the Royal Dutch Medical Association states, physicians are never lawfully required to fulfill a request for euthanasia. If, for whatever reason, they object to euthanasia, they are not required to cooperate. At the General Council, delegates will be asked if there are any elements of the draft framework that should be deleted. There's good reason to suggest the deletion of the whole of Schedule B. This concludes a review of the Canadian Medical Association's draft framework on euthanasia and assisted suicide, and in a moment, I'll sum up. We'll be right back. In this podcast, we've reviewed the Canadian Medical Association's draft framework, Principle-Based Approach to Assisted Dying in Canada, which concerns policies on euthanasia and assisted suicide. This document presumes that physicians have an obligation to kill patients or help them to commit suicide in the circumstances described by the Supreme Court of Canada in Carter v. Canada. It claims that objecting physicians are obliged to support physicians who do so and to facilitate their work. But these obligations are denied by objecting physicians. By presuming them to be normative, the framework imposes a structure for response, discussion, and policymaking that's prejudicial to objecting physicians. CMA officials define participation in the draft framework to mean only providing a lethal injection or writing a lethal prescription. This means that referral is not counted as participation, and the draft framework appears to reflect the view that referral is the preferred method for reconciling conflicts between patients seeking euthanasia or assisted suicide and physicians unwilling to be involved with homicide or suicide. This introduces a fundamental structural bias in framing the CMA approach to accommodating freedom of conscience and religion. The bias in favor of mandatory referral becomes particularly evident in Schedule B, which considers only compulsory referral as a means of reconciling freedom of conscience and access to services. Further, the structural bias is reflected and reinforced by numerous erroneous and substantially misleading statements. What support might be offered to physicians unwilling to provide or facilitate euthanasia and assisted suicide is conditional upon their referring the patient to a third party, but the formulation in the draft framework is vague and has been compromised by revisions to fundamental principles. An acceptable policy will not require objecting physicians to become part of a chain of causation culminating in a morally contested procedure. Despite the bias apparent in the draft framework, it should be possible to reconcile respect for the fundamental freedoms of physicians and demands for access to morally contested services even within the framework proposed by the CMA. The Protection of Conscience Project's detailed critique of the framework explains how this can be done. I'm Sean Murphy, administrator of the Protection of Conscience Project. Thank you for taking the time to tune in to this podcast.
Thank you for listening. To learn more about freedom of conscience in healthcare and the Protection of Conscience Project, visit the project website at www.conscienclaws.org.